You're listening to the sermon from Sunday morning at The Crossing in Columbia, Missouri. Today, we're continuing our series through the Gospel of Luke.
Back in 2017, Burger King drew the ire of the Belgian royal family for its part in an online campaign that it put out as it sought out to establish the first Burger King in Belgium. The online campaign was actually an online poll in which Burger King invited participants, people, to weigh in on an important question. That question was, who's the king? Was it the Burger King or was it the Belgian King Philip? Now, under these photos on this website was this sentence adding a little drama to the situation. Two kings, one single crown, who shall reign? Now, I don't know about you. I think it's pretty funny. You can see why it caught the attention of people, exactly what Burger King had hoped. Unfortunately for Burger King, as you can imagine, the royal family was less than pleased. They came out publicly denouncing the campaign, saying they would have never authorized it had they known what would have been said. Interestingly, as the dust kind of settled, as people started weighing in on everything that had happened, people started to notice that it seemed like at the end of the day, in spite of their anger, the Belgian royal family and Burger King actually shared something in common. They both agreed that only one king can reign. Only one king can reign. Now, when I came across this story, I thought to myself, you know, that's true on a far deeper level. It's true for all of our lives, that there can only be one king. Only one king can reign in our lives. The question is, who will it be? That's the question that Jesus confronts us with this morning. This question, who's the king of your life? Who's the king of your life? Who's the king of my life? Who is the king of our lives? We heard earlier this Sunday, it's Palm Sunday. It marks the beginning of Holy Week, the last week of Jesus' life before his resurrection. And this morning, everything that we've been reading together in Luke, everything before this leads up to this moment where Jesus comes into Jerusalem. Jesus comes into the city to do what? To declare that he's king. Jesus is the king that people have been longing for. He's the king that we long for. And this is, let's pick up in Luke 19, verse 28. After Jesus had said this, he went ahead, going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethpage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, I want to pause here for a second because I want us to notice something. It's easy to miss. I want you to notice that Jesus is coming into Jerusalem. He's coming into the city from the east. Bethpage, Bethany, Mount of Olives, they're all east of Jerusalem. Actually, here's a photo that my wife and I took. We had the opportunity to go to Israel several years ago now. This is kind of the vantage point. It looks different now than it did in Jesus' day, but this is known as the Palm Sunday Road. So we're coming down the Mount of Olives, headed into Jerusalem, up to the temple. And so I'm showing you this because this is the perspective that Jesus would have had as he came into Jerusalem. He came over the Mount of Olives, down through the city, up to the temple. Now, I'm pausing here, and I want us to notice that Jesus comes in from the east. So it's possible that the reason that Luke is telling us these details is because they're true. This is just geographical markers. This is a true story. These events really did happen. These places were, you know, just outside of the city, and so the last two stops on the way into town, so to speak. It's possible, and that really might be the point of Luke highlighting that. But it's also possible that it's much bigger than that. It's possible that by coming into the city from the east, that by Jesus coming into Jerusalem from the east, he's doing something, he's tying us into a far bigger story. How so? Well, to get that story, we've got to go back to the Old Testament book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel, if you're unfamiliar, Ezekiel was a prophet of the people of God in the Old Testament. And as you read Ezekiel, one of the things that you quickly realize is that there's an ongoing theme, and that's the theme of Israel's rebellion. That in spite of God rescuing them, in spite of God saving them, in spite of God entering into a covenant relationship of love with them, Israel continues to rebel and disobey. God blessed them to be a blessing. But instead of being a blessing, instead of living as God had called them to live in the world, what they do is they disobey over and over and over. Their hearts become hardened. Sin and idolatry, it runs rampant in their lives. They disobey and things get really bad. And then God says, enough. I've had enough. And so he gives Ezekiel a vision, Ezekiel chapter 10 and 11. He gives Ezekiel this vision, and what Ezekiel sees is he sees the glory of God fill the temple, the presence of God, the majesty of God, the awe of God, the wonder of God. It fills the temple. And then in this vision, tragically, it departs. It leaves. And catch this, Ezekiel sees the glory of God depart to the east, through the eastern gate, through the city, up and over the Mount of Olives. God's presence was gone. It was a sign of his judgment. Israel's sin had to be punished. And that judgment, if you know the rest of the story, it ended up becoming the fall of Jerusalem and the exile of the remaining people of God. Now, as bad as that judgment was, and as bleak as the book of Ezekiel often is, we're not left, God's people aren't left totally without hope, because in fact, at the very, toward the end of the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel's given another vision. This time, the vision is very different. It's a vision of God's glory returning, God's presence coming back, God being reunited yet again with his people. And guess from which direction God's glory returns. You guessed it, Ezekiel 43. Then the man brought me to the gate facing east, and I saw the glory of the God of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters, and the land was radiant with his glory. The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. See, what Ezekiel sees this time in this vision, he sees a day when the glory of God is going to return, when the glory of God, God's presence, will be reunited with his people in Jerusalem. Which brings us back to Luke 19, where Jesus, the very glory of God, Dave preached on that last week in his sermon on the Transfiguration. Jesus, the very glory of God, he comes into the city. He comes into Jerusalem from the east to do what? To declare his kingship. I am the king. I am the Messiah. But it doesn't happen how people, maybe even how we might expect. Verse 29, as Jesus approached Bethpage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you'll find a colt there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks, why are you untying it? Say, the Lord needs it. Those who were sent ahead went and found the colt, just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, why are you taking the colt? And they replied, the Lord needs it. One of the really interesting things is as you read the Gospels, one of the things that you notice about Jesus is that he loved to walk. He walked everywhere. It's the one thing that he does almost everywhere he goes, town to town, city to city, people to people. The one thing that Jesus does almost everywhere he goes is he walks. And yet not on this day. Not on this day that he comes back to Jerusalem, he comes into the city from the, not on this day, on this day he chooses to ride a colt. Why? Why not walk into the city like he normally does? Well, again, he's tying this into a bigger story. Back to Zechariah 9, we saw this earlier. Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. See, this prophecy was hundreds of years before the day that Jesus came into the city. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. Coming into Jerusalem on a donkey, it was calculated. It was symbolic. Jesus was saying to them, and he's saying to us, he's saying, I am the fulfillment of Zechariah 9:9. The righteous king is here. The victorious king has come at last. Let's continue. They brought it to Jesus, the colt, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they'd seen. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Now, as I've been thinking about, you know, this passage and these verses this week, you know, I try to put myself in that moment. And I want you to do the same for a second. I want you to put yourselves in that moment for a second. This moment where presumably the streets are filled, hundreds, maybe thousands of people. Excitement is growing. Anticipation is building. Everyone, the man, Jesus, that everyone has been talking about has finally come. He's come in and over the Mount of Olives. He's here. Now imagine the shouts. Imagine the noise. Imagine the joy and the celebration. I mean, it must have been incredible, right? These were a hopeful people. Expectations were high. I mean, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. These are people losing their minds. It had to be an incredible moment. Now, I want you to also think about that little donkey. Huh? Yeah, think about the little donkey. Full disclosure, I don't often think about the little donkey and hadn't until recently, but I came across a blog written by a rancher. I also don't spend my time reading blogs written by ranchers, but I did. I came across a blog, and it's one of those things, probably because I don't read this stuff very often, that it just stuck with me. Just her words, because she said, look, here's the thing about donkeys. Donkeys are notoriously stubborn. Donkeys literally don't do anything that they don't want to do, especially an unbroken donkey, a donkey that's never been ridden before. And she goes on to talk about this process of breaking a donkey, and if you want the cliff notes, just go to YouTube and watch videos. It's pretty funny. But she says, look, breaking a donkey, it's long, it's arduous, it's often dramatic, because what a donkey that's never been ridden will do is it'll plant its feet in the ground, it'll buck, it'll turn, it'll twist, it'll do anything it can to get that rider off its back. And yet somehow, Jesus is able to get on that donkey. And not only is Jesus able to get on that donkey, he's able to ride it through a crowd, ride it through hundreds, thousands of people shouting and screaming and yelling and throughout all the... How is Jesus able to get on and ride this donkey through that crowd? Well, Luke doesn't tell us this. Matthew does. That when Jesus sent those disciples to go and find that colt, that next to the colt was an older donkey. Now, most, if you read about this, presume that older donkey next to this younger colt is the colt's mom. And so they go on to say that, hey, it's the presence of the mom next to the colt that brings peace to the donkey. And in fact, it's possible that the mother was walking alongside Jesus and the colt through this crowd, through the shout, through the noise. But I also wonder if maybe it's more than that. I don't know, full disclosure, maybe I'm making too big a deal about this. But the more that I've thought about it, the more that I wonder that if there's something about Jesus, that if there's something about Jesus that in the midst of the chaos, in the midst of the crowd, in the midst of the shouts and the noise and the celebration, that somehow Jesus is able to bring peace. Because after all, Jesus is the one who's able to calm the storm with his words. And if he can calm the storm with his words, then why not bring peace to a donkey? Okay, what's your point, Kyle? Well, my point is this, that if Jesus can calm a storm and he can calm a donkey through a parade, then he can bring peace to our lives too. He can bring peace to our lives in the midst of the chaos. See, I think some of us, maybe all of us to some degree, we're like an unbroken colt. We buck at Jesus' kingship in our lives because sometimes we think about Jesus as constraining. We think about Jesus as controlling, and we say things like, just don't tell me how to live my life. And so what we do is we buck and we twist and we turn and we plant our feet. We do anything that we can to break free. Free to do whatever we want. Free to say whatever we want. Free to be whoever we want to be. Because it seems better to be the king of our own lives. That's what we really want. We want to be the king of our own lives. That's exactly what Billie Eilish says. She says it like this. She says, "My thing is that I can do whatever I want. It's all about what makes you feel good. My thing is that I can do whatever I want. It's all about what makes you feel good." Now, I've used this before, and the reason I'm using it again is because I feel this temptation greatly. That there's a part of me that wants to live like this. There's a part of me that thinks that I know what's best, that I should be able to do whatever I want, because I should be able to just chase whatever makes me feel good, and that's what's going to make me happy. And so I get it. I understand it. But I'm also going to ask the question. It's a question I'm asking myself, but I'm going to ask us a question. If that's how we're living, if that's how you're living your life, and I mean this with sincerity, not with judgment, how's that going for you? I mean, honestly, is this making your life better, or is it making your life worse? Is it making you more or less happy, more or less anxious, more or less satisfied, more or less fulfilled, having more or less purpose? See, I think this idea that we know what's best, that I know what's best, that I'm in control. I mean, the longer I live, the more life I experience, the more people I talk to, the more I realize it's a lie. Jesus is a better king. Jesus is a better king. See, I think we buck at Jesus' kingship because we assume that he's going to use his power to control us. He's going to use his power to manipulate us. But Jesus doesn't want to use his kingship. He doesn't want to use his power to crush us. No, he wants to use his kingship to bring flourishing to us. He wants to give us joy. He wants to bring us peace, peace to the chaos. That's why Jesus came. See, the crowds that day when Jesus entered into Jerusalem, the crowds thought they were getting a warrior king. They wanted a warrior king, someone who would come into town and overthrow the Roman government and set them free from Roman oppression. But Jesus doesn't come into town as a warrior king. He comes as a gentle king. He comes as a humble king. Yeah, he comes to offer freedom, but it's a different kind of freedom. It's freedom from the oppression of sin. See, Jesus, King Jesus came to seek and save the lost. King Jesus came to forgive. King Jesus came to heal. He came to protect. King Jesus, yes, there would be blood spilled. But unlike other kings who spilled the blood of others, King Jesus would spill his own blood. Because King Jesus came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. King Jesus came to rule with love. But that's not what the people expected. That's not what the people expected. And because King Jesus wasn't the king the people expected, King Jesus became the king that they rejected. And shouts of praise and celebration and joy on Sunday, they turned to what? They turned to shouts of crucify him by Friday. And Jesus knew it. Look at verse 41. As Jesus approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it. And Jesus sees the city and he weeps. Coming down the Mount of Olives, he weeps and he says, look, if you had only known on this day what would bring you think you know what will bring you peace. If you had only known what would bring you peace. But now it's hidden from your eyes. Now it's hidden. See, the king had come and Israel said no. The glory of God had returned to the holy city and the people missed it. They missed it because they couldn't see Jesus for who he really was. And I think that begs the question, do we? Do we see Jesus for who he really was, for who he really is, or Are we going to miss it?
Reminds me of an interview Bono did years ago. Bono, if you don't know, frontman of the band U2. This is a while ago. It got turned into a book. It's a pretty good interview. But he's doing this interview with this guy, and Bono keeps slipping Jesus into the conversation. The interview is not about Jesus, but Bono keeps slipping Jesus in, and the interviewer doesn't really want to engage with that. He kind of goes around it every time Bono talks about Jesus, until Bono finally says something. He calls Jesus the Son of God, and you can see that this is kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back for the interviewer, because he goes, okay, come on. Like, really? He goes, great thinker, sure, but Son of God, isn't that a little far-fetched, Bono? Isn't that kind of ridiculous? Jesus isn't the Son of God. This is how Bono responds. It's long, but it's good. He says, no, it's not far-fetched to me. Look, the secular response to the Christ story, it always goes like this. Jesus was a great prophet. Obviously a very interesting guy. He had a lot to say along the lines of other great prophets, be they Elijah or Muhammad, Buddha, Confucius. But actually, Christ doesn't allow you that. He doesn't let you off the hook. Christ says, no, I'm not saying I'm a teacher. Don't call me a teacher. I'm not saying I'm a prophet. I'm saying I'm the Messiah. I'm saying I'm God incarnate. And people say, no, please, just be a prophet. A prophet we can take. You're a bit eccentric. We've had John the Baptist, though. The dude eats locusts and wild honey. We can handle that, but don't mention the N-word. Please, Jesus, don't say the N-word, because you know, if you keep saying the N-word, we're going to have to crucify you. Jesus goes, no, I know you're expecting me to come back with an army. I know you want me to set you free from these creeps, but actually, I am the Messiah. At this point, everyone starts staring at their shoes and says, oh my gosh, he's going to keep saying this. We're going to have to kill him. And so what you're left with, Bono says, is this. Either Christ was who he said he was, the Messiah, or he's a complete nutcase. But the idea that the entire course of civilization for over half the globe could have its fate changed and turned upside down by a nutcase for me, that's far-fetched. I want to go back to that question that I asked just before reading that. And I want to ask it again. Do we see Jesus for who he really is? There's going to be lots of talk about Jesus this week. Maybe lots of opinions about Jesus. He was a prophet. He was a teacher. He's an enlightened man. He's a great guy. He was a nutcase. Are we going to see Jesus? Do we really see Jesus for who he is? Do you see Jesus for who he is? That's the question that Jesus is confronting you with this morning. See, I said that Jesus was a gentle king. He is. But make no mistake, he's confronting you. He's confronting me. He's confronting all of us with a claim. And that claim is this: I am the Messiah. I am the king of all kings. He's your king. And he's saying, you can crown me or you can kill me. You can follow me or you can reject me. But the one thing you can't do, you can't ignore me. You can't ignore me. So the question then becomes, how will we respond? How will we respond to King Jesus? Let me leave you thinking about this question. What part of your life do you need to hand over to King Jesus? What part of your life are you holding on to because you think you know what's best, or because you want the control, or because you're just chasing what feels good? What part of your life do you need to hand over to King Jesus? What would it look like for you to give that to King Jesus? To say to Jesus, to King Jesus, don't just take some of my life, take all of my life, so that we can follow him, so that you can follow him. Let's pray. Oh God, I'll be the first to admit, I want to be king in my life. I think I know what's best. I think I have control. I think that's going to make me happy. Oh God, forgive me. Forgive us the ways that we're bucking at your kingship because we think we know better. God, help us to see. Give us eyes to see so we don't miss it. Give us eyes to see, Jesus, that you are a better king. It's in your name we pray. Amen.
We hope this sermon was encouraging. You can always visit our website, thecrossingchurch.com, for more sermons and resources.